Well, if you're visiting with us, we are embarking in the book of Romans. It started off to probably be a two-year project. It suddenly turned into probably five, the way we're going. We are in Romans chapter 1, and we are, I won't say stuck, we are going to pause at Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, and I've told our people we're going to do probably a 6 or 7 week series on these two verses. Which most people kind of go, oh, he's up to his stuff again. I hope this gets interesting as we move through it. Romans 1, 16 and 17 comes right before this huge section in chapter 1 that deals with some very difficult and complicated issues. And so as we work through this, I think there's a good prep that we need to spend some time in Romans 1, 16 and 17, for the very nature that it prepares us properly for where the rest of the book goes. Let me just read it for you and then show you where we are going this morning. And Romans 1, 16 and 17 simply say this. If you don't have your Bibles, it's on the screen. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, or in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous man or the righteous person shall live by faith. Now, one of the things that we're going to do here is that we look at this statement and most of us go, well, that's pretty cool. It's talking about the gospel. It's the power of salvation to everyone who believes. Doesn't matter what your background is. Doesn't matter what your ethnic group is, what your social economic status is. God has designed the gospel to be accessible to everyone. And so anyone, doesn't matter where they live in the world, they don't have to have certain performance issues, they don't have to get through certain tests, they simply need to recognize that they're a sinner, that the only way they can have a right relationship with God is through embracing his Son and the promise of God that he will forgive us our sins if we receive Christ and bow to his Lordship. And so that part we get, but at the end of verse 17, he makes this statement that the righteousness of God is revealed not only in the gospel for salvation, but in the way that God's people live once they claim to have responded to the gospel. And so what's critical here, and we've talked about this before, is that you have a person who will run around and say, yeah, I'm a believer, I'm a Christian, but they do not live for Christ, I think raises questions as to the viability of that decision. It's not that our works gain us salvation, but they become evidence of the reality that we truly have embraced Christ at a heart level. In verse 17, Paul quotes Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4. And so if you have your Bibles, I'm going to encourage you to jump back there because that's, in a sense, our context for this. Paul's saying, listen, if you've been made righteous through the gospel, then the person who has been made righteous needs from a heart level, from the very core of their being, from the integrity of their own heart, need to be faithful to live according to God's righteousness. That's in essence what we've tried to share with you. And he gets that quote from Habakkuk chapter 2. Now, if you don't know where Habakkuk is, if it's five books, if you work from Matthew and go backwards into the Old Testament, it's the fifth book back. So you run across a couple of Z's. That doesn't mean they were sleeping. Zephaniah and Zechariah were prophets. That's a whole different avenue. And you run into Habakkuk, who was a prophet back in the time of the end of the tribe of Judah. They're getting right down to the time that God's going to bring the Chaldeans and the Babylonians, as it were, to come and take Israel into exile because of their own sin. They have disobeyed God, they've ignored his covenants, they've ignored his pleas for them to repent, and because of that, God's going to bring the Chaldeans, an ungodly nation, and he's going to subject Israel to their army, and they're going to come in and they're going to ransack everything. They're going to take Daniel and other individuals. They're going to get to be taken off into captivity, and they're going to be decimated. And that was part of God's covenant relationship with Israel in the Old Testament. If you obey me, I will bless and protect you. If you disobey me and you won't repent, I'm going to exile you as sort of the final step of my discipline in your life, because you don't have the privilege to live in the promised land if you're not going to live in right relationship with me. So that becomes the context of which this happens. Now, Habakkuk is an interesting book. And verse 2, verse 4 makes a pretty profound statement that we've talked about. It says, "Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous will live by their faith." And the last time I was up here, I suggested to you one of the greatest enemies for God's people in living by faith and living according to God's righteousness is our own pride and arrogance. When we get proud, when we get self-sufficient, when our ego gets inflated, we don't need God anymore, and we can make our own self-determined direction in life. And we can, now, pride doesn't mean I hate God. It just means I can ignore him, I'm indifferent to him, don't need to talk to him, don't need his advice. I can just handle life on my own. And so arrogance doesn't mean someone going around that everybody hates because of their attitude. It's just a person who says, don't need God, I can handle this on my own. And so that becomes the contrast there. But the question is, why does Paul quote this particular verse and talking about what it means to understand the righteousness of God and how to live by faith? Well, if you don't know Habakkuk very well, it is a book where the prophet speaks on behalf of the people, in a sense, back to God. Most prophets speak on God's behalf to the people to give a message. Habakkuk is either on his own or as a representative speaking to God about issues that are going on, and he's got real tough questions to ask God because he doesn't get what's going on. Okay, so let me just walk you through where it starts, and there are two questions and three issues that surface in this. And so if you look at verses 2 to verse 4 in chapter 1, it will say this: "How long, O Lord," and this is Habakkuk speaking to God, "will I call for help and thou will not hear?" Question number one: "I cry out to thee, violence, yet thou dost not save. Why dost thou make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness?" Question number two: "Yes, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contention arises. Therefore, the law is ignored and justice is never upheld, for the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, justice comes out perverted." So let me break this down a little bit for you as we look at each section. If you look at the very first statement, that's what we're going to deal with today, and I want to just outline the three issues, then we'll come back to this. But the first question that he surfaces here is simply this one: "How long, O Lord, will I call for help and you're not hearing?" Let me ask you something. You ever been at a time of life where you were confused by the silence of God? Where you prayed and prayed and begged God and pleaded, and you had all circumstances in your life, and there was a certain desperation because of what you needed to deal with, and God seems to be silent. I don't know about you, but I think we all kind of walk in those streams every once in a while. I could suggest a lot of different things. Jeremiah Johnson wrote a book called Unanswered, and he talks about two kinds of scenarios. He says one of the greatest reasons Christians walk away from their faith and they won't follow God anymore is because of a crisis or an event that happens in their life that brings a lot of pain into their life, and they can't figure out why God doesn't protect them, God doesn't respond to them, God doesn't answer, and so they go, "God doesn't care anymore, I'm gone. If that's the way it's going to be, I want nothing to do with God." The second thing that he talks about in his book is that there's a whole host of other Christians who seem to have questions that they can't find answers for. Doesn't have to be a crisis mode, but they can't seem to get adequate answers in terms of the way they think about it, so they just walk away from God. And so he's written a whole book that's meant to deal with some of these issues, and that's kind of why we're in the book of Habakkuk, because he raises issues that often don't get answers, and that we're going to try to touch on those. Now, let me give you a warning ahead of time. If you think that you're going to get an audience with God all by yourself and to say, "God, I want to know why I didn't get this job in this particular situation because I was the best candidate," you might not get an answer to that specific thing. But what Habakkuk is going to teach us and what we learn from God is what Paul says in Romans chapter 1. What does it mean for you and I to live by faith, to live righteously when God is silent? And does silence mean that God is disappointed in us, or that he's disciplining us, or that he's upset with us, and that's why he won't answer? Now, the Bible doesn't say that's why he does it. We learn that from, like, our parents, right? When we get them ticked off, you have the passive-aggressive parent who won't talk when they're upset because they're afraid they're going to lose it. And so you get these passive-aggressive human experiences, and we think God acts the same way. Or we're afraid that if we ask the question, God's going to unleash on us and start yelling at us because that's the way mom may have responded. I don't know what your experience is, but there's real questions that we grapple with, and there is a real response that God gives. The question is, are we willing to, by faith, to trust and accept that and to live in a way that honors him? So I wish we had time to unpack this particular one. I didn't want to turn Romans 1, 16, and 17 into a 16-week series, so we're not going to cover everything, but we do want to cover some of the pieces. Let me just kind of walk through the rest of these. The next slide or question is, how do we live by faith when God permits moral evil and suffering? That's really the second statement that he makes there. With all this stuff that goes on, the question often is, why are you silent? Why don't you do something? And because God seems silent to many people, especially to Christians, they go, well, he doesn't care. And I guess then, why should I? The third issue is not really a question, but in verses 2 through 4, at the end he says, therefore the law is ignored, and justice is never upheld, for the wicked surround the righteous, therefore justice comes out perverted. The idea is, why do innocent people suffer at the hands of justice or the hands of other people who are unrighteous? Why, God, are you silent? Why won't you respond to this? Why don't you do something? Okay, can you relate to this at all? I mean, is there anything about that that makes sense in terms of life? Okay, good. I just didn't want to be talking to myself here. That's good. So what I want you to notice here, and you just need to slot this in a way, as you think about these first verses in Habakkuk, verses 2 through 4 is not talking about non-Christian enemies, ungodly enemies. This is the stuff that's going on within the people of Israel. Okay, now you need to think about that for a minute. Because why is the reason why many people leave churches and never come back? Well, it's when God's people act badly and they hurt someone by what they say or what they do, and you get the person that says, if this is the way Christians are, they're all hypocrites, I'm not hanging out with them anymore. Not doing any of that. And so as we begin to think about this, this has real ramifications. And the issue is, yeah, they might not be living by faith and righteousness, but the way that I respond to people who act that way aren't living with faith and righteousness either. And so we have a lot to grapple with if we really want to get to this. But the issue here is that these first several verses all deal with the chaos that is going on amongst God's people when they act badly. And often we need to realize that the true test of our faith and our commitment to righteousness is really tested when other Christians hurt us or say things to us that are hurtful or sin against us. Because it's really easy to pick up my sticks and go somewhere else. It's another thing to understand what does it mean to live by faith, trusting God in the midst of these kind of things. So, here's God's response in verse 5. And this is kind of the paradigm that addresses all three of those questions and issues, but each week we're going to unpack them differently. So I want you to kind of walk through this piece this morning, and then we will kind of explain the nature of it as we go. Verse 5 simply says this, look among the nations. This is God's response to Habakkuk after these questions. Observe, be astonished, and wonder. Because I am doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told. Now, I don't know about you, but if I was Habakkuk, I would have some concerns about this. Because my first response would, God, I'm talking to you about this. Who gives a rip about what's going on out there? What are you talking about the other nations for when I'm concerned about the chaos that's going right here with your people? Like, I want a real answer that touches real life here, not something about what's going on out there. But yet there's something in here that I think is valuable for us to understand, and I want to walk you through four truths or principles about how we need to live by faith and what living by faith means and keeping righteousness when God is silent. So here's the first one that we want to look at it. And as I put it together, I grabbed a spider web because I think it helps capture a little bit of the sense of the workings of God in our life that often we don't pay attention to. And the first truth is this. He says, look among the nations. And if I was Habakkuk, I'd be really concerned about, like, why are you talking about them when I'm concerned about this issue right in front of me? You ever felt that way? God seems to be doing stuff all over the place. I need him to do something right here and now. And so it's a little bit like the school shootings in Florida. You know, most of us have a horrific sense of sadness over the tragedy that goes on in situations like that. But in many ways, outside of that sadness, it doesn't seem to affect our life. I mean, it's sad. We'd love to be able to do something. We pray for those people. But for us, most of us, it doesn't touch our life. Now, my wife is a school teacher in one of the schools, and the same thing that happened there, I suspect, happens in most of the schools. In their staff meetings, they're all going, all right, we have to be extra careful about security in case we get people who think that copycatting that thing is something that we have to deal with over here. And so the school systems are all of a sudden going, okay, their antenna's up, they're alert, they're talking about these things because they know there's people that will try to copycat that stuff. Not always, but on occasion. So for them, their life vibrates with the string that got hit down in Florida because they're in a similar context where they know, well, very unlikely, it's possible that they could have similar kinds of situations. And so what happens there affects them directly. The rest of us, it's kind of like, well, it's extremely sad and difficult, and we'll pray for them, but it doesn't touch our life the same way. And that's part of our individualism, but it's difficult. What we have to realize by God's response when he says, look at the nations, and you sort of have to read the rest of the chapter to get this, is God's going to say, I'm going to do something with another nation. I'm going to bring them in here to deal with what you're dealing with in front of you. And so even though I'm silent, I'm still at work here. And what we need to see here is that you and I do not live isolated, siloed lives where it doesn't affect anybody else. Do you remember Achan in the Old Testament? God, when they're going into the promised land, God says, listen, you go in and conquer the city of Jericho, then you're going to the next city. Don't touch my stuff. There's certain things you can do, but there's certain stuff you can't. And you get one individual who goes and steals some stuff because, hey, this won't matter. Nobody's going to miss this stuff. And he takes it back. He sort of conspires with his family. He hides the stuff. And then the nation of Israel goes to Ai, and they get their helmets handed to them, and they get kicked all over the place by the people of Ai. Why? Because one person decided that what they're going to do isn't going to affect anybody, and so I'll get away with it. And it caused the whole nation to lose the power and the presence of God in victory in the next campaign. Now, we don't think that way at all. We think that we can do whatever we want individually. As long as nobody knows about it, it doesn't affect anything. I would beg to disagree. I think one of the reasons that the church in North America has lost a lot of its power in seeing the gospel ripple through their communities is because often there's a lot of things that we think we can get away with individually that actually affect the working of the Spirit of God in the life of the whole body. But we convince ourselves that, no, it's no big deal. And so we stop living righteous lives because we think that we can get away with getting some things out of this world that God says, no, you shouldn't have. But we have to remember that we do not live isolated lives. And the idea here is that our life experiences, good or bad, are intrinsically connected, quote, like a spider web to an innumerable number of other events that God is working in. And so God's going to say, look at the nations. Why? Well, Habakkuk would say, what does that have to do with us? Well, give me a few minutes. I'm going to bring them right to your front door, and then you're going to see exactly how it relates to what you're doing. Now, that's going to take some time But the reason for that is because if God's people won't repent, they won't live by faith, they won't live righteously, they're going to make excuses because this is what everybody's doing, then God's going to say, all right, you won't listen to me, I'll get your attention a different way. And so we don't live this isolated, siloed life where it doesn't affect others. Remember Ananias and Sapphira in the New Testament? They came, sold all that property, came, and the money was theirs, and then they pretended to give it all. And they said, is this everything? And they said, yes, and then one of them dropped down dead. Why? Because they lied about how much they were giving. All they had to say is, no, we're keeping some for ourselves, and here's what we're giving to the church, and they would have been fine, but they tried to look more spiritual and lied about it to the Holy Spirit, and God struck them down dead. Why? As an example that one person's action has a spiritual ripple effect in the whole body. Now, I think God is tremendously merciful, and for if God struck us all dead for being pretenders, you wouldn't have a senior pastor here probably, and I'm going to take a shot in the dark that this would be a pretty empty room. So it really wouldn't matter. And so the issue we have to realize is when God says, look at the nations, there's a connection in terms of what God is doing that hits the strings of other people's lives around us, in our circumstances, in our relationships, that we don't often see, but we're not isolated. And so Israel's conflict is not only messing each other's lives up, it's messing the nation up, but it's also affecting how God is working in the world and what he's going to do. So there's this web of connectiveness on how God is actively working. Second point. He says, observe, be astonished, and wonder. Now, they're very similar and connected here, but here's my point. If we could truly see the complexity and the intricacy of God's activity around the circumstances of our life, we would be astounded. That's what God says to Habakkuk. Wonder, be astounded, be amazed what I'm going to do. And he's going like, what do they have to do with us? I mean, he's as blind as I am half the time. What does that have to do with what's going on in my life? And God says, listen, if I could really open your eyes and you could see my activity and how I'm moving, even nations and individuals and circumstances to be in this complex web of relationships, how I'm bringing different pieces together at certain times, then you would stand back and you would just be astounded by the handiwork of God. But you're so caught up in yourself and all this stuff that's going on. Good concern, but you're not seeing the big picture. 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 15 and 20, Elijah tells the servant that he's with that the Arameans who are coming in to close in around them, we don't have to be afraid of them. Remember the story? Sounds like a fairy tale. He says, listen, you don't have to worry about this. They're surrounded in the city. And he says, God, open up his eyes so he can see what's going on. And so the servant's eyes open, and up on the hills, they see these fiery chariots and horses, in a sense, a representation of the angels of God, the Lord's army that completely outnumbers the enemy and far more powerful. And the servant goes, oh, that's unbelievable. And so God was at work doing something that the servant clearly couldn't see, and only because of Elisha's prayer that God opened his eyes to see something that he was completely invisible to. You see the same thing in Daniel 10, verses 10 through 17. Daniel starts praying and beseeching God, and then an angel of the Lord comes to him, but it's 21 days after he started praying. So for 21 days, there's silence. God's not responding. No answer. Nothing. Does that mean nothing was going on? Nope. The angel says, listen, as soon as you prayed, God was responding. And he was sending an angel to respond to you. But we got into this massive spiritual battle with principalities and powers, which, you know, in our culture, we go, well, that's stupid. We know that doesn't exist. But that's why we get frustrated with the stuff we're going through, because we don't see the big picture. And we don't look at life from an eternal perspective. And so as he comes to this point, God is saying, listen, if you could really see it, what I'm doing, you would stand in awe of it. You would be absolutely awestruck by the things that God is doing. And yet the reason is we can't see it. And so God's silence does not mean that God is not very active at work in the things that will impact our life and circumstances. It might be because of the spiritual battle that's going on. It might be because of the process that God takes. But just because there is silence from God does not mean that he isn't profoundly at work in things around us that we may not see. And so God in the midst of that, and what Paul is saying, is that when God is silent, if you really understand righteousness at the core of your being and you're going to be faithful to that, you will still live by faith and keep the righteousness of God because you can trust him. At least that's the idea. Now, if most of you have gone through times where you feel really desperate and God seems silent, that's way easier said than done. But that's why Paul says, listen, the righteous, those who need to live by faith. Because sometimes life seems horribly unfair. And we don't understand it, especially if I borrow the ideas of verses 2 through 4 in Habakkuk chapter 1, especially when other of God's people act badly. It's the best and most profound and most powerful excuse for people to say, God doesn't exist, God doesn't care, I'm not hanging out with those hypocrites, I want nothing to do with it. And I will propose to you that there may be a lot of ways that we talk about it, but at the core of this is our ability to trust God, that he has our back and he has our best in mind. So, the third idea here is the statement he says, because I am doing something in your days. And in a sense, I've already said this, but the point is that God is always at work even when he's silent. God says, I mean, that's his cry. Habakkuk says, why won't you respond? Why won't you hear us? Why don't you listen? Why don't you give us something? And God says, I am working. I am doing something. And the struggle here is that silence does not mean that we're always under God's judgment. Silence does not always, because that's what we interpret it. Well, if God's not answering me, then he must be mad at me. We saw with Daniel that he wasn't mad at him. There was a spiritual battle going on that delayed the response. We look at Elijah's situation, and he operated in a sense where they were surrounded and had threats around them, but God was going to deliver them. So it doesn't always mean God's angry at us, doesn't always mean God's judging us, does not mean God is passively aggressively a form of discipline. Now, there are negative reasons why God does not hear us. I won't go into them, but Psalm 66:18, if I regard wickedness in my heart, God will not hear. Sometimes God is silent because we've got wickedness in our heart and God's not going to respond or hear in a sense. If we've got wickedness in our heart, James 4:3, you ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives so that you spend it on your pleasures. There are reasons why God won't respond to us as his children when we've got bad motives and evil things going on in our heart and we won't deal with those things. 1 Peter 3:7, husbands, treat your wives right or your prayers will be hindered. And so the idea is if your husband feel like you're praying, nothing's going on, one of the first questions I think that's viable to ask is, how are you treating your wife? So as we move through this, this becomes sort of the paradigm that we need to respond from that God gives to Habakkuk that I believe he gives to us. Now, the fourth one is simply this. He says, you would not believe it even if I told you. Now, they're obviously connected. I am doing a work, but if I told you what I'm doing, you wouldn't believe it anyway. Well, doesn't that sound familiar? How many things does God tell us in his word that we're going like, well, I'm just not buying it. That's too uncomfortable. It's too inconvenient. I'm not going to do that kind of stuff. The truth is God is always at work, even if he does not feel obligated to include us in all the discussions and the plans. Does that make sense? God is always at work, even if he does not feel obligated to include us in all of the discussions and the plans. I mean, that's in a sense, he says, I'm doing a work. If I told you what I'm doing, which actually God is going to tell part of what he's doing to Habakkuk in the rest of chapter 1, But he says, if I told you, you wouldn't believe it anyway. So, like, I mean, you know, for me, it would be like, why am I telling you anyway? You're going to have a bad reaction to it no matter what I tell you, right? I mean, what do you think about Joseph? You know, back in the Old Testament, he has these dreams when he's a kid that all these sheaves of his brothers are going to bow down to him. And he got in big trouble talking about that. You know how that went. But what if God didn't give him that dream, but told him the process that he was going to go through? You're going to get betrayed by your brothers, beat up, sold to a caravan that's going down to enslave you in a house in Egypt, and you're going to live in a pig pen, as it were, or a prison for years. You're going to help other people. They're going to get delivered for the most part, and you're still going to be in prison. Potiphar's wife's going to try to seduce you. You're going to get accused wrongly for that, thrown in prison. And after all that, I'd be going, you know, it sounds good, but, you know, I think I'd rather do something else. I mean, wouldn't you do that if you were Joseph? If God started outlining the process to get you to be the king of the universe, so to speak, and you had to go through all that, I'd be kind of like, I don't think so. You know, that job description, I think I'm okay where I'm at. And that's precisely what Habakkuk does. God says, well, I'm going to bring the Chaldeans in. And he's going like, are you kidding me? You're going to bring these turkeys from over there who are more messed up than we are, and you're going to have them beat us up and take us into captivity because what? So what happens to us in terms of this is that most of us would immediately start complaining that we don't like the end result or we don't like the process if God started telling us the journey he's going to take us on. We'd immediately start a dispute. I mean, think what he did with Jonah. He told him what he wanted to do. What did he do? He just flat out hightailed it in the other direction. That's living by faith and living according to righteousness. How often have we done that? Where we just kind of picked up and went, you know what? Too tough, too terrifying, I'm fearful, I'm out of here. The application is simply this. Let me try to begin to start illustrating this a little bit. What if God allows your spouse to go through a period of suffering to teach him or her about patience, but he also uses exactly the same situation to teach you to be less selfish and more compassionate? Now, that's pretty simple. That's pretty simple, but if our life has this web of connectedness and relationships and circumstances, and that's the way God works, where he pulls the string here and it affects this person and this one over here, they don't see it, but it affects this circumstance over here, God starts moving a lot of different parts to teach different people different things in similar situations. Is God too small for that? Of course not. What do? We lose our keys and we're having a fit like, I don't need this right now, God. Right? Or our spouse has a really bad day and comes home and just is a pain in the neck. And God may have lots of things they're trying to teach them, which we, on the other side, are really hoping for, but God's also teaching us how to respond with compassion, love, grace, mercy, and forgiveness when they come that way so that I can learn more about what he's doing. And God can use that situation to teach five different people five different things in terms of how he's working in their life. But do we really get that? Are we really convinced that God has his fingerprints on the activities of our life so that we become more like Christ? How many times have been like, seriously, what are you doing up there? Get your act together. I need some help here, and I need this fixed, and I need it fixed now. And God, I bet you God's up there kind of like, you know, dude, you got to learn to trust me here. And so as we begin to work through this process, let me try to finish up by a couple things. Here are some scenarios that I was thinking about where God is silent and sometimes very difficult for people. Couple who can't have children. They desperately want to have kids, but they can't have them. They've tried everything. We know some friends of ours that have tried, I think, for 15 years to have kids. And they've tried every scientific trick and thing in the planet and can't seem to have kids. Tough. What about the idea that a person who struggles to find work or being in a job that they hate? It's like, God, I need something to happen here. And God seems silent. What about a person who struggles with depression and God doesn't just fix it? What about the person who has significant health issues and God seems silent to not heal or do what we want him to? Person who wants to get married, in other words, is single, but God is mute about bringing the right person into their life. Do we understand that God still wants us to trust him and live by faith and to keep his righteousness even in the midst of really difficult issues when God seems to be silent? And we all have our own stories. Some people look for a spouse, some don't. Some are going to trust God, some trust God differently. There's a whole element of this, but I've also seen people do incredibly desperate things because this is what I want. I don't care what God's doing. Remember, Jeremiah Johnson talks about Abraham and Sarah who were promised a child. 25 years later, God decides to get around to it. 25 years of silence, and they tried every trick in the book. I mean, if they had the scientific technology, I'm sure they would have tried it. They were eating probably herbs and spices and every other organic thing they could to make this work. They even tried to go, well, listen, take my handmaid and let's do it that way. And God says, listen, I'm going to do this in my time so that I get the glory, so that you know this is completely reliant on me, and you're going to have to trust me in that journey. And it's one of the most difficult things we talk about as Christians, is can we trust him when he's silent and life isn't fair? For those that do, it can be an amazing oasis in the midst of the chaos and the storm if they can learn to trust God and live by faith and keep his righteousness. But it can be painfully difficult because I want what I want. I don't like my circumstances. I don't like pain and suffering. I don't like this stuff. Nobody I know does. And so he is in this process of really saying, what is it? Now, there's three aspects of faith, and let me just mention it, and then I'll finish up because I don't want to overload you. Okay, too late. Anyway. We talk about believing in God. I'll suggest Hebrews 11 talks about we consider that God exists and he's credible. That's an aspect of it. There's a lot of people who will never accept the gospel because they just don't believe God's there. He's not really God. He doesn't exist. He's not real. He's a fairy tale. So they will not, because they can't believe that there's an actual personal being out there, they have no reason to respond to the gospel. Trust is the willingness to have confidence in God and not in self. That's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. All these difficulties and hardships and suffering that brought us to the point of death were so that we would learn to trust in him and not ourselves. And faith is this idea, is to respond to God and his promises so that I know how to act and live. Now, I realize I may be making a little bit of a distinction without a difference here because it's hard to segment these this way. But a lot of people say, well, I'll live for God by faith. I'll do this and I'll do that and I'll do this and I'll be involved in ministry. I'll do that. But sometimes it's really hard to trust God. You know, it's those of us that are the control freaks, that we need to have our hand on everything because we don't trust anyone else to do it because we know they weren't going to do it the way I want to. And sometimes that translates into, I have a really hard time trusting God because I don't think he'll do it the way I want it done either. And so at the heart of this is this challenge. The very point when God is silent is the way we live by faith and live by his right is that we have to learn to trust him in deeper, more significant ways based on the circumstances and the situation I'm going through. It's not just flipping a switch and go, oh, well, the righteous have to live by faith. Good, I can do that. I mean, the problem in North American Christianity is, well, I live by faith because I go to church and I do my best at job and everything else. If you go to Africa, it's like, well, we're living by faith because we're being persecuted and they killed my kids because of our faith. And we don't have anything to eat. So the idea of what it means to live by faith and trust him tends to look really different depending on where you live. And so as you begin to wander through this, let me ask you, what's your faith look like? What does your trust in God really look like? Is God silent in your life in any shape, way, or another? Where the issue isn't really no, and we sort of can tag weight to it, but I'm willing to trust him right where I am now, even when he's silent. The last slide I want to show you is kind of a throwback to when I was growing up. It's the old Rubik's Cube. And I will suggest to you that what we want is God to put all the colors in the same place and give us a nice, neat picture and an answer. And I will suggest most of our lives look like that really scattered, colored one on the one side. And if we ask God to do something, I think he responds, but that means that he has to turn and twist a lot of things and move a lot of different pieces around so that he can get us to the spot where he wants us to be. We don't live isolated, segmented, siloed lives that's disconnected to the rest of life and the things that God is doing. It's a huge web where God is controlling and influencing all the variables and the factors, whether it's people or circumstances, whether it's nations or my kids. And when Paul says, those who've responded to the gospel also need to learn, and I'm adding a bit here, but I think this is the process, have to learn how to trust him and live righteously when he is silent and life sometimes stinks. Because sometimes for many of us, life has more of those issues than easy sailing. And the question is, are you willing to let God move the pieces around as many times as he wants? I mean, he could set his own world record and do it in probably 10 seconds, which is what we want. But sometimes God takes days and maybe years to move the pieces he wants in the places he wants, because what he does in your life doesn't just affect you, it affects others. Not just your family, but other people down the road. Now, this may not be a good example, but the fact that we got out here and I was born in Calgary, Alberta, how in the world would God ever get me out to Minnesota? I never in my wildest dreams said, oh, God, what a dream job. Let's go to Minnesota. And somehow God took me from Calgary to Karenport, back to Calgary, to Leslieville, Alberta for 3.5 years, down to Portland, Oregon, where I pastored for 20 years and did youth ministry to put my resume out where you people thought it was worth picking up. And I came out here to connect with people. And God took years and years and years to do that. Now, like I said, that may not be the best example of, you know, wealth and prosperity, but that's how God works. My dad didn't come to Christ for 63 years because God had to do all kinds of things to help build him to the point where he came to the end of himself and he trusted Christ. But most of us give up on praying for our loved ones long before we see how God's going to finish the answer.